Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nolan. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the conspiracy to assassinate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The question, obviously, is why would someone want to see him dead? My guest is William Pepper. He's a New York City attorney best known for representing Martin Luther King Jr.'s accused assassin, James Earl Ray. Dr. King had reached out to William Pepper in 1967 regarding an essay he had written for Ramparts magazine concerning Vietnamese victims of American napalm missions and was present at Dr. King's famous Riverside Church speech. Mr. Pepper was the citizens' chairman of the Robert Kennedy's run for the Senate in Westchester County and was also a counsel for Robert Kennedy's assassin Sirhan Sirhan, arguing that there was a second shooter. Subsequently, he's been active in the 9/11 truth movement and advocating that war crimes be brought against any former official that supported the war, especially President George Bush. He has advanced degrees from Columbia University, a doctorate in education from the University of Massachusetts, and a JD from Boston College. Among his publications are An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King Jr., as well as Orders to Kill, The Truth Behind the Murder of Martin Luther King. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. I'm pleased to be with you and have long admired your independence and ability to cover issues that not only are ignored by the mainstream media, but by the so-called left liberal media, being too sensitive to be raised, particularly related to political assassinations and 9/11.
I appreciate that. We will discuss that a little later on in the program, the challenges for individuals such as yourself who have information at the very least that should be reviewed and challenged in a legitimate way, but then if you find that after the challenge the information is still of substance, then invite the person on. Give them a forum, debate them, have someone else on debate them. But that has not been the situation, especially on the left, and we will talk about that a little later. In fact, a little later, I will argue for what Chris Hedges said today, what Obama really was, what he meant. And this ties right in. It's a short little piece, but it ties in exactly to Martin Luther King. And also, I will read from another commentary, this one from Bernie Sorez from Activist Post, the psychology of being a non-conspiracy theorist, meaning those who will under no circumstances accept any evidence that challenges the official position, whether it's on 9/11 or JFK or Martin Luther King or Robert F. Kennedy assassinations. So I will share that as part of our program. Before we go into specifics behind the assassination of Martin Luther King as a government-backed operation, I feel that we need to first establish a reasonable motive for certain government agencies or the government itself or individuals to kill King. 9 months before his assassination, Dr. King gave his famous Riverside Church speech, which you attended. You had also communicated with Dr. King shortly before that speech regarding American war crimes in Vietnam, which disturbed him greatly. Now, that speech shifted much of Dr. King's persona as a leader of civil rights towards that of a prophetic visionary speaking for broad systemic change in U.S. government policy and society that addressed other injustices, including the anti-Vietnam War effort and economic forces that were contributing to America's poverty crisis. He was also in the midst of creating a poor people's campaign to demand economic justice for the poor. So when we look at the changes in Dr. King's targets for nonviolent protest, who would have been the leaders, the government agencies, and other influential powers that would have felt so threatened and had such a strong motive for having King assassinated. So take your time and go through each of these possible entities with the rationale for suspecting them.
Right. Gary, there were really two principal reasons why Martin King had to be assassinated. And they really they dovetailed with a core of reasons for political assassinations throughout history, and certainly in the United States in the 1960s. And in a broad brush, if an individual could not be contained, controlled, manipulated, or co-opted in terms of the forces that rule the society, political assassination is the last resort, and that's what they do. That has not been the fate of many dissenters in our history and the history of other nations. With respect to your query, which is right on point, there were two basic reasons. One, Martin had come to be totally convinced that the war in Vietnam was not only immoral, it constituted the manifestation of great war crimes being perpetrated by his government on an ancient people who were being slaughtered. And there are millions, by the way. When I was there, I was a journalist in Vietnam, and when I was there, the photographs that I took and my time in out in the country, which did not endear me to the agency that accredited me, showed massive war crimes, burning of children and women and old people who were basically the remaining residents of the villages. Indiscriminate slaughter is what took place. When I showed Martin those photographs from my files, Beyond the Ramparts piece, he literally wept in my presence. He couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that his government was doing this thing to these ancient and beautiful people. And for what reason? There was no rationale. So the war in Vietnam was a major reason for him being executed, because it was in his position was mobilizing people against the war, which meant it was going to affect the bottom line of major corporations who were benefiting from the war. In the course of my work, I encountered an individual who, I regret to say, was involved in the assassination of Martin King on the military side, but he also had a CIA primary attachment. And he was a briefer of Lyndon Johnson over the course of his tenure. And he was in and out of Vietnam 2 weeks, month at a time. And he used to say to Johnson, he used to say to him, why are we here? Why are we doing this? Why are we in this war, you risking and using all of our blood and treasure? For what, Mr. President, is the reason? Why are we here? He used to do that. He used to say that almost every briefing session that he had. And Johnson used to ignore the question. Finally, one time it got to be too much, and he pounded the table and he said, John, I can't get out of this war. My friends are making too much money. Now, that was a major underpinning of the threat that Martin King, in the mobilization of masses of American middle-class people whose children were being sent off to war, had in opposing this this war. So that was one reason why they killed him. He was going to affect the bottom lines of corporations who were making considerable amounts of money on the war. And as we know, that's a reality. Okay. But, Gary, in my view, that wasn't the main reason why they eventually got rid of him. In my view, the main reason was that he was going to bring a massive number of people to Washington at the Poor People's March. And he had become aware of the vast disparity of wealth between a very small number of people back then. Much worse today, Gary. But back then, he had become aware of the deprivation of all of the necessary resources of life that Mr. Roosevelt desperately wanted to be in a second Bill of Rights, which, as you may know, he called for at the end of his last State of the Union address. And he saw no possibility of this happening inside the structure and the values that were governing the budgetary process and policies of the United States. So he was going to bring these masses of people to Washington. They were not going to demonstrate. They were not going to march. Marchers come and go. They were going to stay camped in the shadow of the Washington Memorial. They were going to visit congressmen and senators. They were going to try to have put back into the budget those social cuts and programs, which are ever more being cut today, but back then he saw as essential to economic liberty and social justice for people. And he was going to bring that mass there, and they were going to remain there until those cuts happened. Now, Gary, the Army knew that wasn't going to happen. The powers, the forces that ruled the society knew there was no way that was going to happen. Guns and butters were going to come out on the side of guns every time. And the only way to stop that movement of people into Washington with the full knowledge that the two roads to power are money and numbers was to get rid of Martin King, because the Army realized that when they were frustrated, these encamped Americans were frustrated, they would likely turn into a revolutionary force. Remember, Gary, 100 cities burned that year in America. Remember, there was a revolution on the streets of Paris that virtually overturned de Gaulle. And if it hadn't been for André Malraux, de Gaulle would have been gone. But a dear friend of mine who helped me in my work on the King case was Marcel Soriguera, who was de Gaulle's personal lawyer. And he said it was Malraux who convinced de Gaulle not to use violence, but to co-opt the communists and the labor union leaders and leave the students hung out to dry, which is exactly what happened in France. So they stopped that revolution. But it was in a movement. It was about to happen. There was this great fear in America that these masses in America coming to Washington would take over the Capitol and there would be a revolution here. Now, the way to stop it was to kill the man who was going to bring them, Martin King. So those are the two reasons, and I think the second one was the most important because they saw it as aborting a revolution. They didn't have the troops to put it down. Westmoreland wanted 200,000 more. They didn't have those. They didn't have the troops to put down that revolution. Now, would the soldiers, even the ones they had, have used their weapons against these masses of demonstrators the way MacArthur's people did against the veterans of the First World War? Highly unlikely. Why has Homeland Security, Gary, budgeted and purchased $1 billion worth of hollow point bullets? What purpose would they have in purchasing that kind of weaponry? Is that going to be used against immigrants? No. There is this fear today rising across the country that eventually this mask will come to Washington and will lead the revolution that Martin King envisioned back in 1968, which they aborted at that point in time.
I appreciate that overview. That certainly gives us a better understanding of motivation. I'm going to read this very short piece now from Chris Hedges from Truthdig, because I feel it's relevant to understanding motive then, motive now. It hasn't changed. Quote, a small secret surveillance committee of goons and thugs hiding behind the mask of patriotism was established in 1908 in Washington, D.C. The group was led from 1924 until 1972 by J. Edgar Hoover, and during his reign it became known as the Federal Bureau of Investigation. FBI agents spied upon and infiltrated labor unions, political parties, radical groups, especially those led by African Americans, anti-war groups, and the civil rights movement in order to discredit anyone, including politicians such as Henry Wallace, who questioned the power of the state and big business. Agents burglarized homes and offices, illegally opened mail, and planted unlawful wiretaps. Bureau leaders created blacklists. They destroyed careers and sometimes lives. They demanded loyalty oaths. By the time they were done, our progressive and radical movements, which had given us the middle class and opened up our political system, were dead. And while the FBI was targeting internal dissent, our foreign intelligence operatives were overthrowing regimes, bankrolling some of the most vicious dictators on the planet, and carrying out assassinations in numerous countries, such as Cuba, the Philippines, and later Iran, Guatemala, Vietnam, Chile, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Throughout American history, intelligence services often did little more than advance and protect corporate profits and solidify state repression and imperialist expansion. War for big business has always been very lucrative and used as an excuse to curtail basic liberties and crush popular movements. Enter Arma Silent Legis, where Cicero said, during war, the laws are silent. In the Civil War, during which the North and South suspended the writ of habeas corpus and up to 750,000 soldiers died in the slaughter, Union intelligence worked alongside Northern war profiteers who sold cardboard shoes to the Army, as the spy services went about the business of ruthlessly hunting down deserters. The First World War, which gave us the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, and saw President Woodrow Wilson throw populists and socialists, including socialist leader Eugene Debs, into prison, produced $28.5 billion in net profits for the businesses and created 22,000 new millionaires. Wall Street banks, which lent $2.5 billion to nations allied with the United States, made sure Wilson sent U.S. forces into this senseless trench warfare so they would be repaid. World War II, which consumed more than 50 million lives and saw 110,000 Japanese American hauled away to internment camps and atomic bombs dropped on defenseless civilians, doubled wartime corporate profits from the First World War. Why disarm when there was so much money to be made from stoking fear? The rise of the Iron Curtain and nuclear weapons provided the justification for big business for sustaining a massive arms industry, for a huge expansion of our surveillance capabilities, and far more draconian assaults against workers and radicals. The production of weapons was about profits rather than about logic. We would go on to produce more than 70,000 nuclear bombs or warheads at a cost of $5.5 trillion. Enough weapons to obliterate every Soviet city several times over. And in the early days of the Cold War, with Hoover and Joe McCarthy and his henchmen blacklisting anyone with a conscience in government, the arts, journalism, labor unions, or education, President Harry Truman created the National Security Agency, or the NSA. Now, that's the end of Chris Hedges' comment, but I feel that what you just said as the motives certainly would mean that there's been an ongoing and sustained effort to make sure that no one, no single personality, becomes so powerful, so popular, so loved, so respected, that they would represent a threat to the status quo. Your thoughts, please.
I think that's right. You know, Hedges' analysis, in many ways, comes on in the context of stuff that Chomsky has written as well, and I they don't really go to the core, in my view, of the power structure of America. Wilson did what Wilson did because Wilson made a deal with J.P. Morgan and the bankers back in 1913, where they created the most powerful financial institution that has dominated American economic life. Hedges and Chomsky don't go there. The reality is that the creation of the, in my view, of the Federal Reserve was the major fault and the major flaw in the in all of Wilson's career thereafter, and they had him in their pocket. So, but picking up on what you have said, I mean, I have dealt with Chomsky in terms of political assassinations, and he doesn't want to go there. He doesn't want to touch it. He prefers to look at the flaws in JFK rather than understand where JFK was going and what he was all about and how much we lost when we lost him. He ignores that. He ignores what happened to Mary Meyer. And I know you had Peter Janney. Peter Janney, as you know, is a client of mine, and I fought with Peter to try to get the story of the assassination of Mary, which is another political assassination, out in the open, because she was going to blow the whistle on the on what her former husband Cord Meyer and the agency did with Jack Kennedy. But you've hit it where they cannot control an individual, and the individual becomes powerful to an extent that he is a serious threat to the existing order. It is at that point, and there have been many of these people in this, in at various levels of government throughout the country, many more than we know about, who have had to be taken out because they couldn't be controlled. They will be eliminated. That is what political assassination is all about, and that is how it rules. The danger, Gary, is that mainstream media, and now the left liberal media, will not deal with this, will not bring it forward, will not reveal this. And that's why people like you, and you're virtually alone, in my view, that's why you have my admiration, you're virtually alone because you methodically, carefully look at these issues and are not afraid to raise them and have them discussed. But, Gary, you're an increasingly substantial voice, but you are a voice in the wilderness. And you know, Mr. Jefferson once was asked, do you want a Democratic government, an elected representative, or do you want a free press, an independent press? And Jefferson, without hesitation, said, independent press. Free press, because the people must know. Well, the American people don't know. They're dumbed down about everything that you focus on, everything you focus on in terms of nutrition and health. I mean, in a sense, when you look at what McDonald's is selling and what the people of this country are taking into their bodies, knowingly, this is being allowed. And this is, in effect, criminal, isn't it? But it's going on.
William, I appreciate those comments. Now we're going to go to a part of the story that many people are unaware of. The King family filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Lloyd Jowers, along with what was phrased unknown co-conspirators. Tell us who Lloyd Jowers, J-O-W-E-R-S, was, and how was it that he became identified as the possible killer? And then prior to the Jowers trial in a civil court, when you were King's family attorney, what evidence had there been up until that time to suggest that James Earl Ray was either not alone as the single shooter or there were others involved, thereby turning it into a conspiracy. And finally, when we look at this, what is the evidence that the government agencies had but would not reveal? Take us on these, because we're going to go further after this into, prior to the emergence of Jowers and his confession, what was the official ruling of the House Select Committee on Assassinations about King's murder, and where there were any peculiarities or suspicious developments in how the committee conducted its investigations?
Okay, wow. You've covered the waterfront, haven't you? Okay, and initially, when they killed Martin King, April 4th, 1968, shortly thereafter, I went to Memphis with Ben Spock, Dr. Benjamin Spock, and we attended the memorial and then went on to Atlanta and for the final rituals. And Bobby Kennedy, I had been Bobby's citizens chairman in Westchester County, New York. I was only a kid, but I had a large following of people. I was the chairman of a group called the Citizens Union. We basically ran the city of Yonkers in a good government way. Had a lot of following. Bobby asked me to run his campaign in that county. I did. I didn't like him. I found he was arrogant. I thought he was removed from the needs of basic people. I didn't know the Bobby they killed. He had changed so much in those 4 years, and everyone I know who knew him convinced me of that. He asked me to work on the presidential campaign, come up to his suite, and I didn't go. Julian went, Julian Bond and Spock and the others went. I had enough of politics, so I dropped out of it, and I went on another way into education, other things. I had my fill. 9 years later, Abernathy said to me, look, I have some questions. I'd like you to come to the prison, interview James Earl Ray, and interrogate him in front of me. And I said, what, are you gone around the bend? We all thought Ray was guilty. He said, no. I said, Ralph, I don't know anything about this. I don't know the facts. I don't know anything. I just wiped my hands off. It took me 6 months, and I dug into everything. We went to the prison August of 78, spent 5 hours interrogating Ray, came away with total conviction, all of us in that room, Abernathy, myself, Reverend Lawson. I had a body language psychiatrist, Howard Behrens from Harvard, who came and just watched James as I put him under this enormous stress. All came out of there saying, look, this guy definitely didn't kill King. We don't know what role he might have played, but he definitely was not the shooter. And that became evident to everyone in that room. Okay. James kept asking me to represent him over a period of years as I went to see him and get more and more information. Went into Memphis. He raised so many questions. I went to Memphis. I kept going back and forth. I was becoming increasingly convinced that there was a much wider net here in terms of conspiracy. Eventually, I became totally convinced in 1988, 10 years later, that Ray was not the shooter and was not knowingly involved, that he was the classic patsy, escaped con. We now know, it's coming out in my third book, the details of how he was, his escape from the prison was manipulated, was organized, how the warden was paid off, how the whole thing happened. We have now the details, who carried the money. How much money and where the money came from. Where do you think the money came from? Money came from Clyde Tolson. You know who Tolson was? He was Hoover's man who used to deal with the Dixie Mafia and others in the South that caused these kinds of things to happen. Tolson gave the money to the man who took it to the ward. Ray's whole escape was organized. Anyway, came convinced he was an unknowing patsy. I finally agreed to represent him in 88. We went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. We lost. We went to the Supreme Court, and we were denied cert, and there was James. Then we did a television trial that went on for about 10 days, HBO and Thames Television in London that Thatcher eventually wiped out, produced a four-hour documentary, and Ray was found by an independent jury from across the country. A federal judge, former federal judge Satt, found not guilty after 7 hours of deliberation. He was found not guilty. And we had a fraction of the evidence that has emerged since 1993. That opened the floodgates, and here come witnesses and evidence. And, of course, that led to the first book, Orders to Kill, now the second book in 2003, Act of State. So James, there's no question James was a patsy. He was used and set up. He was nowhere near the scene at the time of the shooting. That all came down. Okay, eventually, the only way we could try to get this truth out was a civil case. And the King family agreed with me, and I represented them, and we filed the case you just mentioned against Lloyd Jowers and others. We tried that case, Gary, for over 30 days with 70 witnesses. There's a transcript that exists. It's a formal civil trial in the city of Memphis. Most Americans don't even know that it existed. The mainstream media who came in to hear Mrs. King testify, or Dexter King, Andrew Young, would leave the room when the real heavy evidence started being put forward that showed how Martin was killed and why he was killed. It took that jury 59 minutes to come back and to find Lloyd Jowers was liable as a minority. Very small percentage of responsibility, with the major responsibility being on governmental officials, the United States government, state, Tennessee, and city of Memphis. That was the ruling of that jury. And they heard all of the evidence, which is powerful evidence in terms of how King was killed and who killed him. Jowers was not the shooter. He was out there in the bushes. He did conspire. He was a part of the group. He did take the gun from the shooter and run inside the back door of his cafe on the ground floor of the rooming house. And he was seen breaking it down by a mistress of his who was trying to check on him, thinking he was fooling around out in the back. And as he broke it down, he said, "Now, you would never do anything to hurt me, would you?" And she said, "No, no, Lloyd, of course I wouldn't do that." And he goes, this gun was still smoking when he carried it into the kitchen. So he was very much involved in this, but he was not the shooter. So that case went forward, but people don't know what the result was. People don't know how it happened any of that evidence, because the mainstream media suppressed it. They did not appear. And I've had people, principal, major people in media in this country say to me, "Bill, we just can't go there with you because it's not worth our jobs." They have mortgages, they have tuition payments and all of that. One of them, whom you probably know, Frank Gumbel, decided after being antagonistic for the first 7 minutes of a segment on the Today Show that he really wanted to know more and kept me on for a second segment and then fostered some truth to come out over NBC. Brian, of course, was then given another offer, which he couldn't refuse. He went off to CBS and then eventually put out into where he is today, out in the sports wilderness or whatever. But so some people have suffered, and most have just held firm to their positions. Okay, so I'm covering the civil trial, which I, in active state, I went through the testimony of the witnesses in summary fashion. But people don't know about it, Gary, and that's
here's what we're
reality.
Going to do. In fairness to the issue and acknowledging the significance of the research that you have done, which has stood the test of time and was completed in a court two times, one in an official court, one in a court of professionals and juries that found there was a conspiracy. I need you to take us. It doesn't matter how long it takes. We will take you into the next hour if needed. I need this audience to hear, step by step, the orchestration of this conspiracy, the evidence of who was involved, and each step of what occurred. Please share that with us now. Take your time.
Okay. James L. Ray was, his escape from prison was organized in 1967, the year before the assassination. He was put out there, and then he was controlled by a handler whom he called Raul, and they all laughed and said, oh, this is, he made this up. But he was controlled by a professional handler who was working, who had ties to organized crime, but also was working for intelligence. Raul was Portuguese. He had been involved in Portuguese operations in Africa. He was allowed into the United States prior to the assassination of John Kennedy. There were some indications of his role with respect to that one, but I won't go into that. He was assigned the task of controlling James Earl Ray. I encountered witnesses who knew Raul in Houston and Dallas, Texas, and they identified him. He was very close to Jack Ruby, which is an interesting connection as well, and was identified by women who worked for Ruby and by a woman who was Lyndon Johnson's mistress, Madeline Brown. Madeline and I became fairly close over the course of my investigation because she happened to have been in strategic positions where she saw things and heard things that went on because of her relationship with Lyndon. She was at the party at St. Murchison's house the night before the assassination. When Lyndon came in at 10 o'clock and went into Murchison's study with all of the people who were there to give them a 20-minute briefing on what was going to take place the next morning, he came out, put his arms around the back of her neck and said, Madeline, after tomorrow, the son of a bitch and Kennedy's will never embarrass me again. Called her the next morning from Fort Worth, where he said, I'm going to go now and hear the son of a bitch deliver his last speech. So Madeline was in on a lot of these things, but she somehow still loved Lyndon. It took a long time for Madeline to finally come out and put this in a book, which I encourage her to do, called Texas in the Morning, which is virtually banned, I guess, in America. Okay, these same forces, and I'm talking now about, of course, about Hoover and his relationship with the oil men, with H.L. Hunt and the oil people, had determined they would try to destroy King in a variety of ways. If they couldn't, they were going to ultimately, he was going to have to ultimately be killed, which was, I think, Hoover's position from the beginning. At one point, Hunt said, I think Edgar was right. There was nothing else we could do. I acquired all of John Currington's papers. He sat about 15 feet away from Hunt for a large number of years, and he knew about the telephone in the bottom left-hand drawer that was a direct line to Hoover's office. And he, you know, and so John filled me in on a lot of things that a lot of this kind of information. But they had made the decision ultimately that King would have to be killed more than a year before the actual assassination. Okay, they needed the patsy. They got the patsy. He was profiled in the prison. They got him. James Earl Ray was the patsy. Okay. Out comes James. He's now escaped. Okay. Matt is brought in as the head of the the military intelligence group that is the only one in the Pentagon, and it's really his responsibility to organize the military backup for this assassination, which he does. And they chose a team of reservists, and they came out of Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and they were the military that Alpha 184 group that was in Memphis at the time was a backup group. They did not kill Martin King, but they were a backup group. They were there. Ray was moved around the country. They had him in L.A. for quite a period of time. And two of the military snipers, the sniper and spotter, who became informants for me, who fled to Mexico in the 70s because they were convinced there was a cleanup operation going on, and they went to Mexico for their own safety. They were there. They were all there in Los Angeles because that was to be the scene of the assassination. When Martin was to come there from Detroit, that was when they were going to hit him. And that changed suddenly. And they said, well, they couldn't understand why it changed. But all of a sudden they were told they're going to have to move to the south, to New Orleans and then Memphis. And this is pure speculation, Gary, but I think it changed. I think they changed the site of that assassination from Los Angeles to Memphis because it would not be fitting to have two major political assassinations in Los Angeles. And I think at that point in time, they knew Bob Kennedy was going to win the California primary and that Bob was on his way to the White House, and they were going to have to take him out. Bob Kennedy was never going to be allowed to be president. If you want to know how I know about that, I'll be glad to tell you about that particular one.
Divert because it's essential.
Okay. When I came back from Vietnam and my article was published in Ramparts, there was an editor, associate editor at Look magazine called Chandler Broussard. And he contacted me. And he said, Ramparts is a great magazine. It's a muckraking magazine and all of that. But your photographs and your work is so devastating. The masses of people should understand what their tax dollars are buying. So I have convinced Bill Atwood, who is the publisher managing editor of Look, to meet with you and discuss with you what happened. And go over your things. So he said, I've set up a meeting. So I went in to meet with Bill Atwood, and as I walked in the door, he came to greet me, and he said, I'm so happy to meet you, and you'll be pleased to know, or maybe not so pleased to know, I had a visitor last week. And I said, and who would that be? And he said, well, it was Averell Harriman. I said, what did Governor Harriman want? He said, well, he flew in from Washington, and he said he brought me a message from the President of the United States. And he brought me greetings and a message. And I said, what was the message? It was a favor that the President wanted me to do. I said, what was that? He said, well, the President asked me never to publish anything that Bill Pepper wrote. And I said, oh, my goodness. He said, yeah. He said, what do you think of that? You're a young guy. Yeah, I'm 30 years old. And here's the President of the United States is afraid that we will publish something that you would write about this war in Vietnam. I said, well, you know, I'm more interested, Mr. Atwood, in that than that request, which I would expect. I'm more interested in what you said to him. he smiled. He said, oh, I said to him, well, we're going to meet Mr. Pepper next week. And we're going to talk to him, and we're going to review his materials. And if we believe in what he's saying, we're going to publish. And, oh, by the way, give the President my best regards. Gary, that was a day, that was a time in terms of mainstream media that we've never seen again. And that was, this was exactly what he said. And we met for 7 hours and he said to Chandler, let's go with everything that Bill has and let's let the people of this country know what's going on over there. Okay. The next week, my dear friend Chandler Brossard brought Jim Garrison up from New Orleans. Garrison came up, spent late afternoon through dinner into the evening with Atwood and shook him to his shoes. Atwood then called Bobby at 1 o'clock in the morning, woke him up, said, Bobby, I've just had this long session with Bill Atwood. Bill Atwood said, I've had this long session with Jim Garrison, District Attorney in New Orleans, and it follows on a previous one with Bill Pepper on Vietnam. And, Bobby, I'm devastated by what our government is doing. This, he has convinced me, Garrison has convinced me, that the CIA was had operative responsibility for the killing of your brother. And Bobby said, I know that, but I've got to get the White House to unearth it. And number one task will be a whole new independent investigation that I will personally run, and we will get to that. Okay. So Atwood took this this commitment from Kennedy at 1:30 in the morning. And Gary, at 4 o'clock in the morning, he had a heart attack. As we're talking now, he had a heart attack, was rushed to the hospital, left Look magazine, never again to return, except as a roving editor of some kind. And he, my story was never published, and neither was Garrison's. A new editor came in, Chandler was fired, and that was, that was that bit of history. And that's a digression.
What you've just shared with us, I don't know if anyone in America knows. This is really a revelation, and it does set the stage for understanding that association. So thank you for taking that sidebar issue with us. Now, let us go back to the main issue and follow your progress.
Yeah. When I began with Representative James in 1988, and then I went on and we did the television trial in 93, and then witnesses started coming forward. Witnesses came forward who knew Raul, who identified him, who made it very clear he was they knew he was a government guy. It became no question in my mind that he was this was a real operation. They moved the assassination to Memphis because Holloman became director of police and fire. He had been, for a number of years in, administrative, control of Hoover's office in Washington. He was a totally trusted, FBI guy who came into Memphis, was brought into Memphis, conveniently at that point in time. And, they moved James around, and eventually, of course, they had him go into, Birmingham and to buy a weapon. The weapon, which was not the murder gun, but it was a Remington. And they had him bring the weapon up into, outside of Memphis, where he turned it over to Raul the night before the killing. Then he was instructed to go and rent a room, and which he did in the rooming house. And after he did that, and he brought his stuff up to the room and left it on the bed, he was then told to, disappear, go to a movie, just get out of there. That room then was used as the staging room, for the assassination effort. The on-the-ground assassination effort was coordinated by key Dixie Mafia guys who were very tied into the Memphis Police Department. The man who shot Martin Luther King was the best shot on the Memphis police force. He was a contract killer. And he came down the back stairway, and he was in the bushes with a spotter and Jowers. And the bushes were heavily overgrown area. It was remarkable. And how thick they were. So they covered him well. Earl Caldwell, the New York Times reporter, saw people in the bushes after the shot. He came out and he saw them. Solomon Jones, who drove Dr. King, saw somebody come down over the wall. A taxi driver who was killed that night saw somebody come down over the wall after the shooting and run up the street and get into what appeared to be a Memphis Police Department traffic park and be taken away. That was not the shooter. That was the spotter on the scene. Martin was killed from the bushes behind the rooming house. Jowers' job was to be there, to take the gun, bring it inside, break it down, make sure it was secure, and then give it the next day to someone who would pick it up and take it away to be destroyed. We knew Jowers was involved in this because I broke down his mistress after days. She finally, years later, she thought Lloyd was the shooter, and she was protecting him and half fear and half love protecting him. Finally, I broke her down, and she told me the whole story about seeing him come in with the gun and all of that. So then we confronted Jowers with his lawyer present, and we said, we're going to have you indicted. We knew that they blocked the indictment. We knew that the district attorney general was going to allow this. I had a guy sitting outside the grand jury for 2 weeks, a lawyer colleague of mine, waiting for 2 weeks to try to get in. They weren't going to let him be prosecuted, but he didn't know that. Often these people don't know that they may be indicted. So he was desperate. And he finally broke down because he wanted the King family to understand he was sorry. And would they please help him in his last years of life and not see him in prison? And he would, he would then tell everything he knew, which he didn't. He never told us everything that he knew, but he did tell a lot, which led then.
Hold on, back up. Please tell us, what did he tell you?
He told us that, yes, he was out there with the shooter. Yes, that he took the gun from the shooter. Yes, that Martin King was killed with one shot. Yes, he took $100,000. For his collaboration and a forgiveness of all of his gambling debts with Frank Liberto, who was one of Marcello's and sort of lieutenants in Memphis. And yes, he had that kind of full involvement, and he used that money, by the way, to buy a taxi cab company after the assassination. So he admitted all of that. He lied about who the shooter was. He told us the shooter was a man called Earl Clark. Earl Clark was a police officer, a captain, who was an excellent shooter, very good shooter, and a racist as well, and threatened King personally many times, and so he was there as a spotter, but he was not the shooter. That he named Clark because Clark had died. And he did not name the real shooter. The real shooter was a mechanic. In many ways, his name is not significant.
Hold your thoughts, please, for one moment. We are coming up to the end of this segment. For those of you who've been listening, you've been listening to William Pepper, a New York City attorney, best known for representing Martin Luther King's accused assassin, James Earl Ray, to prove his innocence. Dr. King had reached out to William, and you have heard what that reaching out had meant. He had also been a citizens chairman for Robert Kennedy's run for the Senate, and you also heard some of the motives behind killing him as well. This ends the first hour of our program. We are continuing. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is a continuation of our The Conspiracy to Assassinate Martin Luther King Jr. We Know Who Killed Martin Luther King Jr. My guest, William Pepper. And William Pepper, by the way, has a substantial academic background, is known in legal circles and in the writings he has done as a meticulous researcher. He is known for supporting his statements with solid evidence. And he has a strong academic background from Columbia University, Boston University, and also a PhD, as well as a doctor of jurisprudence. And he is the author of some important work that we will get at. Now let us continue with what is important for all of us. Who was the shooter? Then we will see the subsequent cover-up, everything that was done to try to diminish any witnesses that could have been used, as it was done with the John F. Kennedy assassination, to have blown the cover on everyone. Please continue with your discussion.
Right, Gary, let me add a couple of quick things to what you've said. I'm also a member of the Bar of England and Wales. I'm a barrister and in England, and I convened the seminar on international human rights at Oxford University 2 years, and I'm actually going back there. I moved my family to England in 1980-81 because of the I don't want to say the threats on me personally, but the fact that one of my children, who was then four, was picking up the phone and receiving these threats, and I just didn't think this was a proper environment for children to be raised. So I moved them to Cambridge, where I was a research fellow, a visiting fellow, and they were raised. First family was raised in England. I'm back in New York. I am a member of the Bar of the District of Columbia, the state of Rhode Island, and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which was the main circuit that so much of this case was involved in. All right, so we unearthed from Jowers basically the existence of this conspiracy that has not been dealt with at all by the media. And you raised the House Select Committee on Assassinations earlier. They, of course, came on in 1976, and they looked at the assassination of Martin King, John Kennedy, and Martin King, and spent a great deal of money. I don't know what their budget was, but it was several millions of dollars. My own work cost me about $1 million over the course of 25 years of work. They spent much less than that over a period of between 3 and 4 years before the report came out. And they effectively, I won't get into the Kennedy case because I've not spent a lot of time on the John Kennedy assassination, but in terms of Martin King, they effectively whitewashed it. It was an effort just to make it appear that the government had done something, particularly following the work of the Church Committee, Frank Church's committee, in terms of government malfeasance and stuff. So I don't have much time for the work of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and I think there were some good people who did investigative work, but I don't think they were ever allowed to bring things forward. So after Martin King was shot, what we now know is that the spotter, who was Earl Clark, went down over the wall and was seen by a number of people, including a taxi driver, coming down over the wall. James Ory was nowhere in the area. He had taken the Mustang to try to have a spare tire repaired, and when the sirens started coming, he was up at a gas station about half a mile away, started to come back down and saw the police all over the place and then just took off with the car. Remember, he was an escaped convict and very nervous whenever he saw police. So James then continued to drive onto Atlanta. He was out of the scene. Jowers was back in his grill. The spotter went down over the wall. The shooter went back between the two buildings. In between the two buildings. And then went down into the basement of the main building and worked his way through the labyrinth of buildings out until he came up and left through out on the next street, the parallel street, and got into a car and drove away and was seen driving away by one of the witnesses we uncovered, and then was gone. Didn't receive much money. He was a professional hitman for that purpose, and he escaped. And then the whole cover-up network started to come into place, with the FBI basically taking control of the investigation. And a bundle had been dropped in front of Knipes, which was one of the stores near the rooming house. It had a lot of James Ilray's effects that were left on the bed. And it had the weapon, the throwdown gun, which was not the gun and has never been identified as the murder weapon because it wasn't the murder weapon. Somebody got into the second Mustang that was parked further south. And then just drove away so people could see a white Mustang driving away, which was the car, of course, that James had. So the whole thing was structured and set up that way. They didn't count on little things like we would find a man waiting for his wife who worked across the street, and he parked behind that getaway Mustang, and he saw the license plate on it. It happened to be an Alabama a license plate. It wasn't a Memphis or a Tennessee plate. It was an Alabama plate. Of course, James's car did not have an Alabama plate. So, I mean, there'd be little things like that that they simply couldn't control. Then Jowers was locked up. He had his money. He bought his cab company, and he thought he was safe until we started to unravel this and tale. Then we forced him into meetings with his lawyer present, and he finally broke down because he didn't want to be indicted. But he was the target of the lawsuit in order for us to bring out the evidence we had. We brought a civil action, and the case against Jowers was the purpose for doing that. So, I mean, I think the rest is history. In 1999, the jury found that Ray had no involvement, no knowing involvement, but Jowers and government agents had involvement. And that's how Martin King was killed. The King family got closure for the first time in this case. With that action, I think Coretta died knowing that finally that what she had suspected all along was the case, that Martin King was killed by operation of the government of the United States.
Share with us the difficulties and obstacles that Representative Walter Fauntroy, a friend of Dr. King's and a 20-year member of Congress, had during his chairing the subcommittee investigation, and even later in the early 1990s when he left Congress and continued to look at the raw documents that led him to observe J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI and even the Green Berets having been involved in the assassination.
Well, I think Walter is a tortured soul, frankly. I think Walter Fauntroy was placed in a situation as a member of Congress where he was basically the lead in terms of the King investigation, but he had to tolerate an inept, inadequate investigation. And I can't get inside Walter's head. We've talked a lot of times, but I can't get inside his head and know exactly what was going through his mind or why he got compromised to the extent that he just was not willing to come out. I think Walter suffered a lot of pressures, one sort or another, economic or whatever. He has tried to survive. So I'm sympathetic to Walter, but I don't. I'm not as favorably inclined to him as I have been to people like Hosea Williams, who are just determined that the truth would come out as to who killed Martin and some of the other members of Martin's organization.
Similar to unusual changes that took place in Dallas law enforcement leading up to the JFK assassination, there were also suspicious activities within the Memphis Fire and Police Departments, even up to 2 hours before the shooting, such as the removal of Ed Reddit and an African-American detective with the Memphis Police. First, how did the Memphis Police Department contribute, in your view, to King's assassination? And second, how is it explained that King did not have a special bodyguard during this trip to Memphis as he had on previous trips? And finally, did organized crime or the mob play a role in conjunction with the Memphis Police?
Yeah, those are all very good questions, Gary. Number one, Ed Reddit was removed because he was part of a two-man surveillance team at the fire station who were watching the balcony and the parking area of the hotel. Their job was to pick up license plate numbers, individuals who were coming supposedly to organize. They weren't there thinking of any assassination. But Willie B. Richmond stayed on. Reddit was removed because he wasn't actually a part of the Memphis Police Department Intelligence Division. Ed was more of a community relations guy whom they assigned because he was black. Richmond was also black, but Richmond was intelligence, and he was more trusted than Reddit. So Reddit had to be removed. Two black firemen also were assigned elsewhere on that day because they might see something or have heard something that's what we think anyway. And so they were assigned elsewhere. So those guys were removed. There were two military photographers on the roof of the fire station. They were put there by the captain of Carthel Whedon. They were put there by the captain of the station. When they showed credentials, they said they simply wanted to photograph things. No question in my mind that they photographed everything that went on, including the shooter. Their photographs, of course, went inside. That fire station was strategically diagonally located. Willie B. Richmond kept notes on everything he saw. And that's how I came to learn that Billy Kiles was a liar. That Billy Kiles, Reverend Billy Kiles, was never inside the room with Martin King a half hour before the shooting, as he has always maintained. But that, in fact, he went and knocked on the door to try to get Dr. King out onto the balcony at about 10 minutes to 6. They were going to have dinner at Kiles' home. He knocked on the door. The note showed, and Richmond testified at trial, that somebody came to the door, opened it for a brief time, spoke to him for 10, 15 seconds, closed the door, went back inside, and Kiles then walked down the balcony. He walked north on the balcony about 100 feet from room 306. When Martin came out onto the balcony, I always thought it was strange that Kyle's never came over to stand alongside him, because that's what he would have done. It's an ideal photo op and all the rest of that, but he didn't. He stayed far away down the balcony. I always thought that was strange until I really had a chance to go through Richmond's notes and show that, that he was lying. He was never in the room. And therefore, a whole range of suspicion about exactly what he knew was going to take place, you know, was raised. Martin, with this stage set, now understand this very carefully. Within 15 minutes of the killing, or 20 minutes of the killing, a hotel employee knocked on the door of the room of the invaders. There were two rooms occupied by invaders who were black Panther-type militant groups who were there working with King to make the next march for the sanitation workers a peaceful one, because on March 28th, it had not been peaceful. It had been disrupted by people brought in from St. Louis and Chicago, Blackstone Ranger types, right? So from Chicago. So the local Black Power group wanted to work with Martin, and Martin wanted to work with them, and they were meeting, and everything was going fine. And about 20 to 6 or so, here comes this knock on the door, and the woman says, "Now you're going to have to leave." They said, "What do you mean you're going to have to leave?" They say, "You're going to have to leave. SCLC has said they're not paying your bill any longer." And he said, "What do you mean they're not paying our bill any longer? First of all, bill's paid already for the day. What do you mean they're not paying our bill any longer? And we're working well with Dr. King." And he said, "Who's telling you this?" He said, "Reverend Jackson. Reverend Jackson says you have to get out of here. You have to leave. We have to remove you." Said, "Jackson, we're not even dealing with Jackson. Why are you dealing with him? Who is Jackson coming from doing this thing?" And anyway, that the invaders got fed up. They said, "Well, King doesn't want us here. We're gone." And they packed up. Now, they were a potential loose cannon of a group. They were a group that potentially could have caused problems because, one, they were armed. Two, they could have seen something. So they had to be removed, just like the firemen had to be removed, and Ed Reddit had to be removed. So they were setting this whole state right up to the last minute. Martin comes out on the balcony. Abernathy does not come out with him. He starts out, they says, "Oh, Martin, I forgot. I got to put some aftershave on." He goes back inside. Martin's out there standing alone. And that's when... of course, within a very short period of time when he was hit.
Go back one moment. Who specifically and under what conditions or under oath and what evidence to state that it was the Reverend Jesse Jackson who told this person to tell those people to leave the room?
Izzy Harrington of the Invaders was the one who was told this by the... by the hotel person. I got this. I interviewed, most people never did this. I took the time to interview every one of the invaders, and I got this information from the invaders.
Right.
One of them also told me that I should have no illusions about Reverend Jackson, that when he went from South Carolina to Chicago, he was given a letter of introduction from Strom Thurmond to Richard Daley, asking that Richard Daley give him every solicitation, every cooperation in the city of Chicago. I never saw that letter. I didn't know anything about that. I just was told that.
Okay, but that's hearsay. That is hearsay, and that in and of itself, as you know, would not withstand a cross-examination and trial. I'm principally interested in things that we could verify or things that were brought out and withstood cross-examination in a court of law. Now, tell us more about the shooter. What were you able to determine about the hit? You called the person a hitman. That means he had involved himself in previous assassinations or murders.
Well, I don't know that this guy was involved in previous assassinations or murders. I don't know that. I know that he's a deadly shooter. I know that he's a racist. I know that he was a contract killer. I want to let a lot of discussions, the discussion about him and the details about him to await the end of my final research on this third book, Gary, if you don't mind.
Okay, that's fine. Not a problem. Let's go back then. During the trial, you were involved with, there were a lot of testimonies presented by local Memphis residents and others who gave witnesses, or gave witness to the shots having come from a plot of bushes and not right. from the building across from the Lorraine Hotel balcony where King stood when he was shot. There were also photos of people pointing in a direction away from the building. So share right. with us some of the most convincing witnesses and stories that provided the jury evidence that the official story of where the shooter was when inaccurate, and then speak on the controversies over the murder weapon, supposedly a 30-odd 6 Remington rifle, and the reasons why this could not have been the weapon King was shot with. And if Ray was the fall guy, how was it that he was the one selected to set up and be manipulated and among all others? Why him? Could you address these points?
Well, yeah, let's go one at a time. Let's take the Ray. Ray was profiled as a professional I don't want to say criminal, but he had been involved as a in a number of petty, not always nonviolent types of crime, but he was a con. He was somebody who they profiled as someone who would follow instructions, who would be grateful for the possibility of getting outside of a prison and doing what he was told. And that profiling was done by under the Department of Corrections in Missouri and carried out by the warden and his staff. So Ray was well chosen by them. And the reality is he was that type of personality. I don't know what else one can say about it. I'm sorry. What was your further query about the gun?
Well, it was supposedly a 30-odd 6 Remington rifle, and the reasons why this was not the weapon King was shot with.
Yeah, the bullet matched the. There was no match of the bullet to they could never match the fragments of the bullet to the throwdown gun. That was never done. They were never able to do that. The rifle was a special rifle that was brought in for the purpose of this assassination, and some of the information is still coming out as to where it came from. It looks like it was organized by Tolson and brought in specifically and given specifically for this purpose.
It sounds like you have a little distraction there.
I have a 3-year-old. You know, what happened was I got stuck in traffic coming back, and I've been talking to you all this time from my car.
Oh,
that's all right. I know, Gary. I'm grateful for your time. You know,
no.
all the good work you do.
We don't have a problem. I'd like to focus on some of the government agency involvement behind the King assassination conspiracy. So yes. what can you tell us about the Army, 111 Military Intelligence Group, and the later evidence involving the CIA, such as the testimony of Jack Terrell and the role of J.D. Hill, who was later murdered or perhaps assassinated himself?
Okay. Terrell agreed to help me at one point in time, and we had the names of the of the reserve unit that was put together, and Hill was on that list, and so we sent him. We tried to get to Hill, and Hill was eventually killed. He was killed allegedly by his wife, but it was a .357 Magnum with five bullets in the center of the chest, and that's too big a gun for that little woman to have had. So we think Hill was killed. Hill had a problem of drinking. He started talking, and that was the end of the. That was the end of the story for Hill. So far as I'm concerned, the unit was chosen by the head of the military intelligence group in the Pentagon at the time was John Downey. John Downey is a very mixed bag as far as I'm concerned, because he's the man I just mentioned to you earlier was briefing Lyndon Johnson and was so upset about the war in Vietnam. When Johnson came out with that story about, my friends are making too much money, John, I can't get out of this war, John went home that afternoon and told his wife, pack your bags, we're going to Canada. And this was in 66. And he was gone. And his daughter told me Johnson would call the house every once in a while and they would say he was on special assignment and so forth. And they discovered that he was just gone. He was so fed up and so disgusted with that war that he wasn't going to cooperate anymore. So, and I think he was a patriot in that sense. Then he came back. I believe he honestly believed when he took over the 902nd Military Intelligence Group in the Pentagon, agreed to take it over and agreed to run the assassination operation against Martin King, which involved putting together the military units, the Alpha 184 team and all of that. I think he believed, this Pennsylvania guy believed that King was a threat to the country. And that he his assassination was justified. I believe that he honestly he believed that. That's whatever one can say about it. I think he did. Anyway, he was the one that put together the Alpha 184 team. They were there. They were a backup team. There were two snipers and two spotters, and they were not used. When the civilian shooter carried out the shot, King went down. They were told to disengage immediately and leave the scene, which they did. But the Army, that was the Army involvement. He also coordinated the photographers on the roof. He had the photographers on the roof, so they had a photograph of everything that was going on there. The FBI took control of the investigation on the ground, and basically with the cooperation of cooperating Memphis police officials carried out that investigation. The forerunning operation leading up to this was put together by key Dixie Mafia operatives with money provided from Hoover's FBI through Tolson. I never realized the extent to which Hoover used Tolson to carry the money and be the guy who was dealing with the people on the ground. And the Dixie Mafia, of course, related very closely to Marcello as well. Marcello had two lines into this. through the Dixie Mafia people, who were very well connected in Memphis, and through his own organization in Memphis. Lucchese was the godfather in Memphis. Liberto was a lieutenant in that organization. And so Marcello had his own people prepared to do what had to be done. Liberto had very good connections with the Memphis Police Department and, of course, also with Lloyd Jowers, who was a gambling debtor of his. So you have all of these forces together. And it was Liberto that organized the on-the-ground operation with Holloman. Holloman played a major role. Holloman played a major role in constructing and organizing all of the events and then covering them up. The mayor knew everything that was going on. There was no one in a serious position of influence in the city of Memphis that was not involved in knowing that this was going down. But they knew what they had to know only because of roles that they were going to play. The next morning, the police called on the Public Works Department to send a team into South Main Street and go behind the rooming house and totally sanitize the entire crime scene, which is, of course, what they did at that point. And they just wiped out every aspect of evidence that was there. They took care of, cut down all the bushes, did all of that sort of stuff.
At the conclusion of the trial, the jury found Lloyd Jowers and government agencies guilty of an actual conspiracy to harm Dr. King. However, This has not changed the official record that continues to hold to a lone shooter theory of James Earl Ray murder. Although this is not a high federal court, it was a court nevertheless, and it is more than anything that has been accomplished to prove there was a conspiracy behind the murder of JFK or his brother Bobby. Now, for a final comment here, and this I think it gets to the basis of everything. Even when conspiracies orchestrated by our government are proven to be true, there continues to be a blacklisting of allowing these truths to become part of our history and better known throughout the public. In the meantime, conspiracy theories are used as a weapon by the government to discredit critics.
Yes.
And if we call someone a conspiracy or conspiratorial theorist, it is similar to calling them a kook or a nut. This is becoming true even in much of our, as you mentioned, liberal media, and I'll let you talk about that in a moment, where many people on the left will categorically deny or won't touch on certain controversies such as 9/11 or the truth behind the treatments for AIDS and the multi-hundred-billion-dollar industry that has been funding many of the support groups, or in fact, many different things they won't touch on. They just stay away from it. Now, in that respect, before we come back for your final comments, I want to read an article that I believe is relevant to all this, and then you'll have your opportunity for closing statements. This is from Bernie Suarez from Activist Post. It is called The Psychology of Being a Non-Conspiracy Theorist. There is a brand of people amongst us. They have no name, but they exist. They are everywhere at work, at home, at school, in the streets, stores, shopping malls. It is highly unlikely not to know someone who belongs to this category. It is the so-called non-conspiracy theorist. You know, the guy who tries to terminate conversations by alleging that you are nothing more than a conspiracy theorist and the information you share is false or not believable. Yes, that guy. Let's meet face-to-face with your typical non-conspiracy theorist. We all know them. They often are the ones who hold the conspiracy verbal accusation as a valid logical denial point in any argument. The logic works like this. Conspiracy theorists say, you're claiming that fire alone can cause a building to self-implode, descend at free fall speed into its own footprint. That's physically impossible. What about Newton's laws and the laws of thermodynamics and such? Mm-hmm. Non-conspiracy theorists say, no, you're wrong because you're a conspiracy theorist. And with that, often the non-conspiracy theorist will walk away. What's happening? Mm-hmm. They had nothing to elaborate on. So the non-conspiracy theorist, whose thinking is engineered and controlled by government, mainstream media, and Hollywood entertainment, resorted to a socially engineered answer. For this reason, it is fascinating to explore the mindset and psychology of the individuals who take this position in place of a logical stance. By definition, conspiracy means a group of two or more people secretly plotting or conspiring a harmful deed against another person. This behavior is part of human nature. Humans have been conspiring against each other since the beginning of time. There was never a time in world history when such an elementary behavior of conspiring against an enemy did not exist. Can you find a period in history when a certain human emotional trait or action did not exist? Was there a time when the human genome didn't express jealousy, game playing, free trading, rage, or happiness? As odd as it is ridiculous, as this may sound, non-conspiracy theorists unknowingly subscribe to this logic. If evidence points to a conspired crime, why not treat it as such? Why demonize the very concept of conspiring? This is a core defect in the thought process of non-conspiracy theorists. You can easily identify them by their speech. What the non-conspiracy theorist doesn't see is that the battlefield is right before them and they have outsourced all critical thought and action to a government thinking service known as the mass media. Like being in a football field while the ball is in play without realizing what is happening. You see people waving at you in the stands to get out of the way, but you don't understand what they're saying, so you continue walking on the field with your headset on. Likewise, non-conspiracy theorists perceive all logic and reason, arguments, and warnings made by the conspiracy theorist as noise. They don't understand the warning, and so they continue living and carrying on with what they're doing, like the person on the field not understanding the warning being communicated by those in the stands. Non-conspiracy theorists cannot receive the basic signals of logic and reason. The headsets adding to the confusion is like the TV and mainstream media news, since they themselves refuse to look at the evidence. They put their faith in the government and in the mass corporate establishment to safely guide them in their reality. They gain a sense of psychological protection from this overall system. And since the information being believed is almost always artificial, they need to hear their own opinions repeated to them by the voices on TV so they can confirm and reconfirm their own belief system to themselves to be legitimate. At no point will the non-conspiracy theorist plan a day of research or dedicate a few hours every once in a while to research the topic or put any thought into issues. Information and world problems are but one category in a shelf of categories that make up their lives. The non-conspiracy theorist ignores that government has always implemented social engineering and mass mind control on the general public. In order for the non-conspiracy theorist to confidently walk away from someone who challenges their belief system with scientific facts, they need to have a sustained comfort and assurance that what government and mainstream media is saying is true. The non-conspiracy theorist is thus profoundly psychologically interconnected with today's mass mind control paradigm. They are a species representing a full byproduct of 21st century social engineering. The doctrine of this type of social engineering programs, it believes its believers to believe that when government and media accuse someone of conspiracies, then this accusation is cause for someone being considered diseased, the symptoms being paranoia. But paranoia is based upon systemized delusions, and delusions are based upon false beliefs. A proper exploring of meanings, brings us back to proving what is true or false. We come full circle and the spin is over. Non-conspiracy theorists don't realize they dwell in this circle of misapplied words, never exploring the meanings or doing the work to determine what is true and what is provable. Non-conspiracy theorists therefore wake up every morning and reach for the mental orientation map known as the mainstream media news. Without it, they would be disoriented, as they would not know what to believe. They actually believe that if anyone was guilty of wrongdoing at the highest levels of government, someone would speak out every time and everyone would know it. They ignore that state secrets are the norm and government operations are conducted in secret. They ignore the consequences each individual at the government and military level faces for blowing the whistle. Despite these consequences, many individuals at government level still risk it all and do blow the whistle on government. Despite all this, the idea of maintaining state secrecy is a myth to non-conspiracy theorists. The idea that government would do something immoral, nefarious, or criminal is a fiction, as well as the non-conspiracy theorist. In conclusion, the history of war, corruption, tyranny, fascism is incidental, coincidental, insignificant, and irrelevant to the non-conspiracy theorist. None of these should be used to gauge the events of our time, since history is a thing of the past. Non-conspiracy theorists choose not to connect the historical dots. According to them, there is nothing to learn from the history of tyranny and totalitarianism. Anyone attempting to connect the dots is likely a conspiracy theorist. This goes hand in hand with the logic defeat we discussed earlier, as the earlier case of the conspiracy theorist having his scientific arguments debunked by virtue of simply being diseased with the accusation of conspiracy theorist. Note, the non-conspiracy theorist used the name as a loaded, proven concept with power to permanently label someone diseased. In this case, attempting to connect the dots automatically tags you as a conspiracy theorist. As far as non-conspiracy theorists are concerned, all critical thought is deferred to the authorities. The scientists do their work and then report the facts to the government and the mainstream media, who carefully announce to the masses what they should know. Any scientist who speaks out and claims to have evidence contradicting government claims must first be endorsed and approved by the mainstream media and government. Without this approved endorsement, the scientists are marginalized, no matter how large their numbers are. Without these ridiculous rules, the delusion of being a non-conspiracy theorist cannot be maintained. This is the psychology of tyranny. Tyranny and totalitarianism cannot be implemented without mass mind control. This dangerous groupthink mentality will ignore all warning signs to help continue advancing the agenda. And so the non-conspiracy theorist is the most important instrument for maintaining control of the masses. Without these non-conspiracy theorist vessels of the global empire, the plan would not be possible. It is quite possible that years from now, the concept of conspiracy will return back to where it belongs, right next to other concepts like jealousy, laughter, love, stealing, fighting, friendship, hatred, and other human expressions that define who we are. By then, perhaps being a friendship theorist, a stealing theorist, a jealousy theorist will be the new propaganda boogie monster term. Or perhaps years from now we will be sick and tired of this vicious cycle of physical and mental slavery. Perhaps people will truly have enough of the control system and we will abolish it. I'm thrilled to be considered a conspiracy theorist by those still controlled by the social engineering experiments of the last 100 or so years. We have proof that humans are able to critically think on their own and prefer to be free. We are the embodiment of the resistance. We never run from challenges and debates. We recreated the media and are responsible for the progressive death of the mainstream media. We choose to give humanity a voice outside of the socially engineered control system. We rely on firsthand accounts, physical evidence consistent with natural laws, factual documents, common sense, high probability, and forensic scientific evidence before jumping to conclusions. We do not rely on name-calling to give strength to our position, and we stand as a reminder that the human mind will never be completely contained. unraveling the reality we face became normal for us at some point. And the information the non-conspiracy theorists considered scary is common news to those of us who they call conspiracy theorists. In total conclusion, in order to be considered a conspiracy theorist by the non-conspiracy theorist, you must believe that government is corrupt. Believing that others are corrupt does not get you the title automatically. The list of what qualifies someone as a conspiracy theorist has been changing rapidly, and today is determined by mainstream media, and government is real in real time. Today, only government and mainstream media gets to decide who qualifies as a conspiracy theorist. The thought process of the non-conspiracy theorist is thus predictable and automated because the agenda being followed by government and mass media is predictable. The mindset is no. The research required by Associated Press, NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, CNN, and NPR doesn't agree to report it. Then all other sources must be false. This shines a light into the thought process of the non-conspirators. That is one point of view. I would like you, since you have been considered a conspiracy theorist, even though you have won your arguments, you have presented your evidence on this, your final thoughts on this, please.
I agree with that analysis. I agree with your comment. I believe that the non-think approach to these issues, the unavailability and unwillingness to deal with contrary factual information by so many people is a harbinger of tyranny. It's absolutely necessary for government to have control over the masses of the people. Once again, the two roads to power are money and numbers. And if they cannot control the numbers, which they increasingly are doing now through control of the media and control of all sources of information, they are in trouble. And what I have found, though, Gary, coming up against these people called non-conspiracy theorists, what I have found is that it's a very interesting psychological phenomenon. Almost always, I find these individuals have personally identified themselves with the government, and government, and therefore government actions are, they're almost metabolized. They're a part of their whole sense of self. And if you start attacking government and government actions for people who have so deeply imbued themselves in this kind of devotion and belief, you are effectively attacking the concept, their concept of who they are, of their own selves. That's what's difficult, to get them to change, to transform the concept of who they are as human beings when they have so identified here in this country, as I've not seen it elsewhere, frankly, but in this country, to such an extent. I didn't see it in France. I haven't seen it in Europe. And even in England, I didn't see this absence of ability to separate the concept of self from independent thinking and critical thought. And it starts, I think, here at the very earliest ages of education, where children are not at all encouraged to think critically, independently. And I think it flows on then up into adulthood, and it's, of course, embellished by necessity of earning a living and being accepted and socially accepted and so forth. You know, and I couldn't understand why at various times Supreme Court justices who are appointed for life could not be independent thinkers in terms of things of this sort. And then as I looked at individual members of the bench, I said, it's their social acceptance. It's their acceptance as human beings and their concept of who they are in a community that often governs them in this way. This was one of my side comments and concerns about The Guardian, which I regard as the greatest newspaper, frankly, in the world. When Russ Bridger became close to Tony Blair for the first time, some of the independence of the Guardian during that time seemed to be waning, I think they've returned, but that concerned me about the Guardian at that point in time. So that's a comment on what you've just read. It's inimical to where we are as a society and as a people, and thank goodness for people like you and your program in attacking all of this, not just in politics, but in nutrition and health, the pharmacology, everything that has to be looked at. But we will not change the society on a piecemeal basis. That's my view. This society has gone into such decay, and it'll only be a total transformation. And that's what Martin believed long ago, and it's much worse today than when he lived. It'll require a total transformation of the society and its values and its structures to change and every aspect of life. And I know you're about that business in terms of what you do, and those of us who wish to see that dream fulfilled can only just persevere as best we can. The evidence in the King case is clear. You're right. People of this country do not know it. But I will tell you something else. The evidence in the assassination of Bob Kennedy and the Sirhan case, which we are fighting now for many years. I've been on that case now for 6 years in the courts in California, is stronger. The evidence of Sirhan's innocence and his use by powerful forces is stronger than it was in the King case. And I mean, another time, another program, I can go through the details of that evidence bit by bit, so that will be understood.
We're coming up to the end of our program. We're going to do a very in-depth analysis of We Know Who Killed Robert F. Kennedy at that time, as we will with Gandhi. One final postscript, and I'd like your input on this, and that is, you have two Nobel Prize winners for peace, Martin Luther King and President Barack Obama. Knowing what we know about King, and knowing his emotional constitution, and knowing his strength of character, knowing his fearlessness to stand up against all issues and to join with those who have been abused and neglected, and never having profited from them as others in the office who claim to be a moralist at the higher order, and wasn't it William Blake who said it, a truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent? And so we have people who claim to live as a Martin Luther King, but as far as respect for people. But in his time, King was hounded. He was harassed. His groups were infiltrated. He was set up. He was blackmailed. They wanted him to commit suicide. This was J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI and also the White House. Now, today, with the National Security Agency, there is no longer a secret. The president meets every Tuesday with the National Security head and decides who to assassinate without due process, without habeas corpus. They simply decide this person should be killed, and it is done with massive teams of assassinations within special forces and all with black op budgets. And then today we find out, through the leaks of Snowden, that every single protest in the United States, whether you're an environmental protester against genetic engineering of seeds, whether you're protesting something on the student loans, Occupy, no matter what your protest, the FBI is keeping track of you, everything is monitored, and you're put on an enemy's list. And we do not know the extent of that, as Chris Hedges has so stated and enlightened us to. What would be the likely outcome today? The irony of this, where Martin Luther King leads a movement against the wealthy and the power and corruption that they maintain and the inequality they have created, the home foreclosures, the derivatives market, the gaming the LIBOR interest rates, the derivative markets, the buying of politicians. And he were to lead a march today to try to challenge all of this, what would be the conversation between one Nobel Peace Prize winner and the effects it would have upon the man marching the other Nobel Peace Prize winner? Have you ever thought of that?
Oh, indeed, I have. The second Nobel Peace Prize winner brought a serious stain forever on the Nobel Prize. The President of the United States, whom you're referring to as the second Nobel Peace Prize winner, has emerged, in my view, as not only hypocritical, but a liar and a force for all of the forces, the corporate forces who dominate life in America. His secret attempts to push through the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is as bad and worse than what Clinton did with NAFTA back in the 90s. This man is, in my view, despicable in terms of the values of freedom and democracy in this country. Martin would stand up against him forthrightly and challenge him. He would use every means at his disposal to discredit Martin King and such a movement. And it may well be, Gary, that he's going to be given that opportunity, because I see across this country, from contacts that I have, the development of a mass movement to go to Washington and to confront the tyranny that has slowly, gradually, and quietly emerged over this nation. The militarization of the police forces in the towns and the cities, and the whole surveillance operations have brought us to the point where increasing numbers of people are saying, bastante, enough, enough. I think in the near future, relatively near future, there will be this mass movement to change the society. Let's... And Obama will be tested severely by this movement. And if he's not in power, Hillary Clinton or whoever, whichever other lackey of the corporate masters, will be tested.
Let us not forget those who've screamed the loudest to deny the virtue of evidence from those who've uncovered conspiracies have been the corporate Democrats and the corporate liberals and all media, including the alternative media. William Pepper, thank you for being on for this 2 hours. We appreciate very much your substantial scholarship and insights in bringing to our attention and to some resolution of our curiosity and thought the truth. Now we know who killed Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome, Gary, and thank you very much for all you're doing and continue to do.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.
FM for more empowering ideas from Progressive Voices.